Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I'm very excited to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Dava Sobel. Dava has spent her entire professional life as a writer, beginning as a technical writer for IBM and then moving right into journalism, where she was a staff reporter for New York Times, and then following a freelance reporter for 20 years. Her journalism took her to some really great places like Space Camp, and even a 25-day stint as a research subject at a chronophysiology laboratory. Then in 1995, the successful publication of Longitude turned Dava into a full-time author of books. So tonight, Dava is here to present her newest book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos. So if you would please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dava Sobel.
Thank you very much. I don't really need to stand on the box, do I? No, good. Good, thank you. I'll say thank you, too, for coming out to this wonderful independent bookstore. This may be the most inviting bookstore I've ever been in. So I'm very excited about this book because this is something I've wanted to do for a long time, write a play about Copernicus. And the play is inside the book. And the play was something that I thought might stand alone. I always envisioned it that way, just writing it as a play. But after a few years of talking, writing it, rewriting it endlessly, talking to my editor about it, he came up with the idea of writing a book around it so that the real story, as much as anyone knows of it, would be in the book. And my imagining of a real meeting that took place, in which nobody knows what was said, could be at the center of the book. So that's the play. That's the meeting between Copernicus and the young visitor who talked him into publishing his crazy idea of the Earth being in motion. Because it certainly doesn't feel like it's moving, does it? And it was a tough sell at a time when it was not only contrary to common sense to imagine that the Earth was moving, but might be dangerous in terms of religious authority, what people would say about an idea that seemed to contradict the Bible. And it might even be a laughable idea, because it seemed so unlikely, so improbable. So the exercise of stepping away from the play, writing the book, was a huge relief for me because, honestly, I was worried the whole time working on the play about putting words in the mouths of real people and of what Copernicus might say to me for suggesting that he really was having an affair with his housekeeper. You know, I kind of had to do it for the sake of the drama. There was a lot of evidence that it was true, but nobody really knows. So once I had the story in place, I had more freedom to go back and revise the play and take more liberties than I had taken before. And I think the play is better for that, because the play is not supposed to be an astronomy lesson or a history lecture, right? That just wouldn't work. But the So the book is more like what I normally do, narrative nonfiction. Playwriting was a complete departure. But now that I've done it once, I'd like to do it again. It's very challenging. That's all I'll say about that now. We could talk about it more if you're interested, but I think I will just read a few places from the book, if that's okay. So I'm starting not at the very beginning, but on page 4 of the first chapter, if anybody's following along. The bold plan for astronomical reform that Copernicus conceived and then nurtured over decades in his spare time struck him as the blueprint for the marvelous symmetry of the universe. Even so, he proceeded cautiously, first leaking the idea to a few fellow mathematicians, never trying to proselytize. All the while, real and bloody revolutions, the Protestant Reformation, the Peasant Rebellion, warfare with the Teutonic Knights and the Ottoman Turks, churned around him. He held off publishing his theory for so long that when his great book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres finally appeared in print, its author breathed his last. He never heard any of the criticism or acclaim that attended on the revolutions. Decades after his death, when the first telescopic discoveries lent credence to his intuitions, the Holy Office of the Inquisition condemned his efforts. In 1616, On the Revolutions was listed on the Index of Prohibited Books, where it remained for more than 200 years. The philosophical conflict and change in perception that his ideas engendered are sometimes referred to as the Copernican Revolution. He was christened for his father, Mikołaj in Polish, Niklas in German, his native tongue. Later, as a scholar, he Latinized his name, but he grew up Niklas Kopernik, the second son and youngest child of a merchant family from the copper mining regions of Silesia. Their ancestral village of Koperniki could have taken its name from the Slavic word for the dill plant, Koper, or from the old German term for the metal mined there, copper. Or maybe it commemorated both those products of its hillsides. In any case, the roots of Koperniki's etymology lay long buried by the time its younger generations began leaving home to seek new fortunes in the towns and cities. An armorer named Mikołaj Kopernik appeared in the city chronicles of Krakow in 1375, followed by mention of the mason Niklas Kopernik in 1396, and the rope maker Mikołaj Kopernik in 1439, all bearing the names of their forefathers' homeland and its popular patron saint. Around the year 1456, the alderman Mikołaj Kopernik, who traded in Hungarian copper, moved north from Krakow to Torun, where he married Barbara Watsonrode. They lived on narrow St. Anne's Lane, later renamed Copernicus Street, and raised four children in a tall brick house that is now a museum to the memory of their famous son. From the double front doors under the house's pointed arch, their two boys, Andre and Niklas, could walk to classes at the parish school of St. John's Church, or down to the family warehouse near the wide river, the Vistula, that coursed from Krakow past Warsaw through Torun, carrying the flow of commerce to Danzig on the Baltic Sea. Soon after the boy Niklas reached 10 years of age, the elder Niklas died. His bereft sons and daughters and his widow, Barbara Kopernik, turned for succor to her brother, Lucas Watsonrode, a minor cleric or canon in a nearby diocese. Or perhaps Barbara, whose date of death is not recorded, had predeceased her husband, leaving her brood true orphans. Either way, the children came under their uncle's care.
Canon Watzenrod arranged a marriage contract for his niece Katerina with Bartel Gertner of Krakow and consigned his niece Barbara to the Cistercian convent at Kulm. His young nephews he supported at school, first in Torun and later in Kulm or Vloklavek, until they were ready to attend his alma mater, the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. By then, Uncle Lucas had risen from a mediocre position in the Catholic hierarchy to become Bishop of Varmia. A page of Gothic script in the archives of the Collegium Maius at the Jagiellonian University attests that Nicolaus Copernicus, age 18, paid his tuition fees in full for the fall of 1491. He studied logic, poetry, rhetoric, natural philosophy, and mathematical astronomy. According to the courses in his curriculum, his father's copper and other common substances could not be considered elements in the modern sense of the periodic table. Rather, they comprised some combination of the four classic elements, earth, water, air, and fire. The heavens, in contrast, consisted entirely of a fifth essence called ether, which differed from the other four by virtue of being inviolate and everlasting. Ordinary objects on earth moved more or less along straight paths, whether seeking their natural places in the world order or being compelled by outside agents. Heavenly bodies, however, lay cocooned in celestial spheres that spun in eternal, perfect circles. The motions of the planets captured Copernicus's interest from the start of his university studies. At college, he purchased two sets of tables for calculating their positions and had these bound together, adding 16 blank pages where he copied parts of a third table and wrote miscellaneous notes. This custom volume and other remnants of his personal library, seized as spoils of the 30 Years' War, now belong to the University of Uppsala, Sweden. Copernicus more than once explained his attraction to astronomy in terms of beauty, asking rhetorically, "What could be more beautiful than the heavens, which contain all beautiful things?" He also cited the unbelievable pleasure of mind he derived from contemplating things established in the finest order and directed by divine ruling. Among the many various literary and artistic pursuits upon which the natural talents of man are nourished, he wrote, "I think the ones above all to be embraced and pursued with the most loving care concern the most beautiful and worthy objects, most deserving to be known. This is the nature of the discipline that deals with the godlike circular movements of the world and the course of the stars." One of the things I read from my research was Copernicus's own book, which I cannot really recommend as reading. It about killed me. It's really a textbook in spherical geometry. And the very beginning talks about this unusual reorganization of the spheres, putting the sun at the center. But in the course of the book's publication, an anonymous preface was added that told people not to take it too seriously. You know, this is just for calculation. It's no worse than anybody else's theory, better than many of them. But if you're looking for truth in astronomy, you will leave this subject a bigger fool than when you entered it. So, fortunately, Copernicus didn't know about that anonymous preface because he really believed he had hit on the actual structure of the universe. And that was very unusual for that time because people thought there was no way to know that. The best you could do was to come up with the best possible mathematics that would most closely match the observed motions of the planets, and that would allow you to predict their positions so you could cast good horoscopes, which was the major use of knowing the positions of the planets. And Copernicus had to train also as a physician. He was the personal physician for the bishop. And in medicine also, people used horoscopes. You needed to know your patient's horoscope in order to be able to make a good diagnosis and also the proper treatment and to know when to administer treatment. So he knew about all those things. He never says whether he really believes in astrology. And it's been assumed by historians of science that he was modern in that way, that he didn't believe in astrology. But, in fact, he merely said nothing about it. And there's a new scholarly book just out called The Copernican Question, which considers this and tries to make the case that he probably was an astrologer. So he had this idea. He wrote about it to a few friends, a few mathematicians he knew, which was the way scientific ideas were put abroad in an age before journals. And then if you were on the receiving end of that kind of letter, you might copy it over and send it to other people you thought might be interested. And a dialogue by correspondence would get started. And Copernicus had done that around 1510. And in the letter, he said that he was working on a big book that would explain all the math and give all the background needed to support this idea. And then 30 years went by, and the book never came out. So a young man in Germany, genius mathematician, learned about Copernicus's work and was very interested in finding out more about it and just set off to visit him. So he traveled. He was actually from Wittenberg, but he was already in Nuremberg, which was even farther away. So he had about a 500-mile journey to make and just did it. So I'm going to read you a little more from the end of the first part of the book. This is on page 76. In May of 1539, a youth, a brilliant mathematician, entered the city in search of Canon Copernicus. No one had invited him or even suspected his arrival. Had he sent advance notice of his intent to visit, he doubtless would have been advised to stay far away from Varmia. Bishop Dantiscus's most recent anti-heresy pronouncement, issued in March, reiterated the exclusion of all Lutherans from the province. And 25-year-old Georg Joachim Reticus was not only Lutheran, but a professor at Luther's own university in Wittenberg. He had lectured there about a new direction for the ancient art of astrology, which he hoped to establish as a respected science. Ruling mundane abuses of astrology, such as selecting a good time for a business transaction, Reticus believed the stars spoke only of the gravest matters. A horoscope signaled an individual's place in the world and his ultimate fate, not the minutiae of his daily life. If properly understood, heavenly signs would predict the emergence of religious prophets and the rise or fall of secular empires. Reticus had left Wittenberg the previous autumn, in October 1538, amidst squabbles over some vulgar verses written by a friend of his to mock Martin Luther. On leave from his teaching duties, he had spent months traveling around Germany, intent on seeking out the best practitioners to enlighten his understanding of astronomy and its astrological applications. In Nuremberg, He learned for the first time of the Polish canon, who accounted for the celestial motions by centering them on the sun. This concept seemed to Rheticus a redemptive cosmology, and without delay he undertook the 500-mile journey to northern Prussia to learn the details of the theory from its source. The name Rheticus derived from a place instead of a person. Rheticus would have used his real surname if allowed to, but his family had been stripped of that privilege after his father, the physician Georg Iserin of Feldkirch, was beheaded for his crimes in 1528. Some accusers branded Iserin a sorcerer. Others called him a thief who had come into their homes to give medical care, but left with their valuables. Rheticus, 14 at his father's execution, first took his mother's maiden name, De Porus, but later changed it to the more German-sounding von Lauken, which meant the same thing, of the leeks. At the start of his university studies at Wittenberg in 1532, he acquired the toponym that tied him to his Alpine homeland of Russia. Rheticus had begun school with an interest in medicine, but displayed an uncanny aptitude for numbers. He quickly came under the wing of the renowned humanist scholar, Philip Melanchthon, the teacher of Germany, and also Luther's trusted supervisor of university affairs. As Rheticus later reported, the fatherly Melanchthon pushed him toward the field of mathematics, to the study of arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy. In 1536, rather than lose Rheticus after conferring on him the Master of Arts degree, Melanchthon established a second mathematics professorship especially for him to fill. Rheticus, now 22, marked his transformation from student to faculty member at Wittenberg with a public inaugural address. Feeling awkward at the center of such attention, he warned his audience that he was shy by nature and most dearly cherished those arts that love hiding places and do not earn applause among crowds. Nevertheless, he acquitted himself admirably in his oration. "It is characteristic of the honorable mind," he said, "to love nothing more ardently than truth, and, inspired by this desire, to seek a genuine science of universal nature, of religions, of the movements and effects of the heavens, of the causes of change, not only of animated bodies, but also of cities and realms, of the origins of noble duties, and of other such things." Mathematics, he avowed, united all these pursuits. In addition to their mutual regard, Rheticus and Melanchthon shared a devotion to astrology that did not include the dubious Luther. "Astrology is framed by the devil," scoffed Luther at table one day, "for the star peepers presage nothing that is good out of the planets." As espoused by Melanchthon, however, astrology contained no taint of devil or magic. Its tenets were upheld by the text of Genesis, which told how God placed lights in the firmament of the heaven, not only to divide the day from the night, but also to serve as signs. Rheticus had, of course, cast his own horoscope. His birth, in the very early hours of February 16, 1514, coincided with a conjunction of the moon and Saturn in the 12th house. There was no mistaking the ominous import of these conditions. They augured an abnormally short lifespan. As an adept astrologer, Rheticus knew several ways to rectify a bad chart. In one experiment, he technically escaped his fate by moving his birthday to the previous day, February 15th, and changing the time from 9 minutes before the second hour of the morning to 3:26 in the afternoon. These alterations divided Saturn from the moon and moved them into separate houses, granting him a reprieve. But it seems unlikely that such fiddling would have rid Rheticus of the fear of impending doom. A sword, like the one that had severed his father's head, hung menacingly over his own. So, those were the main characters.
They wound up working together for 2 years, despite the prohibition against Lutherans in Varmia. And Rheticus actually left with a copy of Copernicus's manuscript. Copernicus kept his original manuscript. He had been working on it for a lifetime, and I like to think he just couldn't bear to part with it. And it survives to the present day, which is remarkable for manuscripts of that at that time. They were routinely destroyed in the printing process. But the real thing is still with us. It is kept in Krakow in a safe, and I was lucky enough to see it just for a few minutes. And there's a famous page where he drew his diagram of the cosmos, and that page is reprinted in many places, but the real page has a hole in the middle. And that got me to feel very close to his process. So why don't I read one more tiny bit from the very end, and then I would love to have comments, questions. Okay? So now I'm on page 234. And you may have heard Copernicus's bones were exhumed, and floor of the cathedral kind of ripped up to find him, and the positive identification was made, but then they had to rebury him. The second burial of Canon Nicolaus Copernicus took place in Fraumburg, that's the modern name of Frauenburg, on May 22, 2010. Unlike the first funeral, the pageantry of this one drew a large crowd and included a mass led by the Primate of Poland, the country's most highly honored bishop. Not since Copernicus's uncle Lucas Watzenrode carried St. George's head here in 1510 had this cathedral seen a more triumphant procession focused on funerary relics. A new black granite tombstone with a stylized golden sun and planets now flanks the earlier memorial installed in the cathedral in 1735 to replace a still earlier epitaph destroyed during wartime. Beyond such plaques, statues, and other public tributes, his fellow mathematicians continue to afford Copernicus their professional recognition. The first cartographers of the moon named a large lunar crater for him in the 1600s, and space age explorers launched an orbiting astronomical observatory called Copernicus in 1972. For the 537th return of his birthday on February 19th, 2010, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry announced the naming of superheavy atomic element number 112, copernicium, symbol CN, in his honor. Every time the Kepler spacecraft, currently in orbit, detects a new exoplanet around a star beyond the sun, another ripple of the Copernican revolution reverberates through space. But the counter-revolution that sprang up in immediate reaction to Copernicus's ideas also continues to make waves. State and local governments still claim the right to control what can be taught of scientific theories in classrooms and textbooks. A so-called museum in the southeastern United States compresses the Earth's geological record from 4.5 billion to a biblical few thousand years and pretends that dinosaurs coexisted with human beings. Copernicus strove to restore astronomy to a prior pure simplicity, a geometric Garden of Eden. He sacrificed the Earth's stability to that vision and pushed the stars out of his way. To contemporaries who doubted the grandiose dimensions of the heliocentric design, Copernicus replied, "So vast, without any question, is the divine handiwork of the most excellent Almighty." In the century after his death, the Inquisition struck that line from his text.
Although Copernicus clearly meant to express confidence in the omnipotent's ability to transcend ordinary proportion, the censors saw the statement as an ungrounded confirmation for an earth in motion. When the earth moved, despite the church's objections, Copernicus became symbolic of a new fall from grace. Because of him, humanity lost its place at the center of the universe. He had initiated a cascade of diminishments. The Earth is merely one of several planets in orbit around the Sun. The Sun is only one star among 200 billion in the Milky Way, and relegated to a remote region far from the galactic center. The Milky Way is just one galaxy in a local group of neighbors, surrounded by countless other galaxy groups stretched across the universe. All the shining stars of all the galaxies are as nothing compared to the great volume of unseen dark matter that holds them in gravitational embraces. Even dark matter is dwarfed by the still more elusive entity, dark energy, that accounts for three-quarters of a cosmos in which the very notion of a center no longer makes any sense.
Yes.
Where is this so-called museum in the southeastern United States?
It's in Kentucky. It's near the Ohio border in Kentucky. It's called the Creation Museum.
Wow.
Have any of you been there, heard of it? Yes? No? Yeah, I went because I thought I needed to see what the opposition was saying. And I think I almost expected it to be a lark, but it's very not funny. And it's an elaborate museum. A tremendous amount of money went into creating these dioramas, and there are many, many school buses in the parking lot. Yes, sir.
David, thank you for coming to Denver, and thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing. I'm curious about that original manuscript that you saw and the hole that you saw in the center of that illustration. Do you think that was intentional? Is that whole place like where the sun would be?
I think the hole was just the natural consequence of... Oh, the question was, yes, I'm repeating the question. Do I think the hole at the center of the diagram was to indicate the sun's position? I think it was the natural consequence of drawing eight concentric circles with a pair of compasses. So you have that sharp point that always comes down in the middle, and that's what drilled the hole. Yes?
Theories that are here that may be accepted and you know, in one day may look at in another perspective, such as the theory of global climate change.
The theory of
global climate change.
Yes. The question is, am I familiar with Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions? And do I think there are any parallels in current science? And for those of you who haven't read it, Kuhn believed that most scientists did what he called normal science until a new idea, he used the term paradigm, came along, and then that overturned everything, and people had a new kind of normal science to work on. And I think we do continue to see things like that. I think the plate tectonics revolution in the 70s was an example of that kind of thing. In fact, I remember trying to write about that. I was curious as to how the new theory had changed the teaching of geology at Harvard. And when I started interviewing people, I discovered that it had changed the teaching of half the faculty, and the other half were clinging for dear life to the old theory. So these upsets are violent and difficult for the people in the fields.
nowadays we have string theory, but I don't think most... I think a lot of scientists have a lot of questions about string theory. So... But it is a yeasty time, you know, there's lots going on, particles possibly moving faster than the speed of light, new ideas about what dark matter might be, all kinds of stuff to think about. It would be great to live another 100 years or so and see how this plays out. Yes?
Can you tell us a little bit about the play, and was that based letters or some conversation, or what book do you use, or what letters do you use to base for?
Great. Let's talk about the play. So the question is, upon what did I base the play? Were there letters? Copernicus left only 17 letters compared to 1,000 for Galileo and even more for Kepler. So the record is thin, distressingly thin. Three of the letters, however, mention the female housekeeper and how angry the bishop is about her presence in Copernicus's home, and he forces Copernicus to make her go away. So that was something to go on. The content of the conversation, of how this young man presented himself to Copernicus, whether there was any issue about his remaining in town. The way I imagined it, Copernicus's first reaction would have been to try to make him go away, because A, he didn't want to publish his ideas, and B, the fellow was dangerous. And how could it be? He was in enough trouble with the housekeeper. All he needed was a heretic to come and be there too. But nobody knows what went on between them. There is absolutely none. The only clue is the visitor wrote his own synopsis of Copernicus's theories. He was a much better writer than Copernicus. And this is part of the way he convinced Copernicus to publish. He wrote this brief summary, again, as a letter. It was addressed to the person who probably sent him to Copernicus in the first place, one of the mathematicians in Nuremberg. And he outlined the program. Of course, he soft-pedaled it a little bit. He talked about other things first and how great this was going to be for astrology. But he did put it out there, and that was published in 1541. And the fact that the world didn't blow up probably was a strong motivation for Copernicus to go ahead and finish his book and see it published. In that letter summary of Copernicus's idea, Rheticus says that he was ill when he arrived, and that his teacher, Copernicus, took him to the neighboring diocese, where they stayed for about 8 weeks. So, was he really sick? Were they hiding him someplace where it was safe for him to be? Another thing that interests me, all the people involved in the story had some kind of portrait painted in their life. The printer, Copernicus certainly has an iconic image. Other astronomers of the period, there's no image of Rheticus. He wound up, his own dire prediction for his short life was incorrect, as horoscopes so often are, and he lived to be 70 years old. And he had several teaching positions, he wrote several books. How come there was never a picture of him? So those kinds of mysteries gave me ideas about what I wanted to happen. Rheticus also got into some very serious trouble after Copernicus's book was published. He had a teaching position in Leipzig, and the father of one of his students pressed charges against him, saying that Rheticus had gotten this young man drunk and performed terrible acts upon him, and pressed charges for sodomy. And at the time, that was a crime punishable by death, by burning. And Rheticus left town immediately. He did not try to defend himself. He just left. So that was certainly a character indication. So I had a lot to go on. Yes, sir.
How do evolutionists answer the question implied when Newton wrote, quote, gravity explains the motion of the planets, but gravity does not explain what set them in place, end quote. The implied question being, how did the Earth get placed in the orbit?
Are you asking me how evolutionists explain how the Earth got placed in orbit?
That's correct.
Yeah. I cannot follow their arguments, frankly. Do you mean anti-evolutionists?
I'm sorry.
You mean how do people who defend Darwin answer Newton's statement about? Because Newton believed in a divine creator.
Yes. Which I left out of my question. Yes.
Yes. Well, people who believe in divine creators also believe in evolution. It's not a clean split between atheists and people who have faith. Evolution is a very convincing argument, more than a theory. And I know several people who are religious, believe in God, but still find no problem with evolution.
But you have not found any evolutionist-based explanation for how the Earth got made into such a stable, precise orbit.
I think the laws of physics provide ample explanation for how the Earth got to be where it is. I'm happy with that. Let's take a vote. How many people are happy with the laws of physics having... Okay, let's... Anybody else have a question? Comment? Yes, sir.
He didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater in the sense that he kept some elements of the Ptolemaic system. Correct.
Yes, the question is, Copernicus didn't really throw the baby out with the bathwater because he kept elements of the Ptolemaic system in place. The reigning genius of astronomy was Ptolemy from the second century, who had written a book that everybody read. And the idea that the planets moved in perfect circles was something Copernicus clung to, even though it isn't the way things are. So, and also he wanted to corroborate what Ptolemy's findings were, but do it in a better way that was truer to more basic principles, to really having the planets move uniformly. And Ptolemy's planetary theory fudged a little bit on the uniform motion. And so Copernicus was looking to clean that up. And in the process of doing that, he came up with the idea of having the Earth and Sun switch places.
So it was a cleaner mathematical or a simpler mathematical scheme?
Copernicus's scheme answered the question of why the planets moved backwards. Once you had the Earth in motion around the Sun, you could explain the backward motion of the planets as not backward motion at all, as really an optical illusion of the Earth just catching up on an inside track and passing them. So that seems a lot cleaner. What was Copernicus really struggling with in his hesitation to publish? I think he was struggling with several things. He was worried that people would twist passages from the Bible to censure him, which is why he dedicated the book to the Pope and asked for the Pope's protection if people did that. Mathematics is written for mathematicians, he said. An idea that was echoed later by Galileo. The Bible is a book about how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And he was afraid of being laughed at because the idea sounded insane. When you thought about the speed that the earth would have to attain to do what Copernicus wanted it to do, it was just completely incredible. I mean, we all say, oh, of course we know the earth moves. But if you hadn't been taught that, it's not an easy thing to figure out because your senses certainly don't give you any clue. And the Ptolemaic system, the whole structure of Aristotelian philosophy hinged on the earth being fundamentally different from everything else, being made of these four substances and being at the center where things would just fall, whereas everything in the heavens were perfect. So how could you take the earth, this sinkhole of decay, and make it a wandering star and take a celestial body like the sun and put it in the hellhole? So these were all things to worry about. But he, at the same time, was convinced he was right. The other thing that happened when he made the earth and sun switch places was that there was suddenly a reason for why the planets had different speeds. No one knew the order of the planets, especially Mercury and Venus, whether they were before the sun or beyond the sun, or one was in before and the other was beyond. Once he put the sun in the center, he knew how they lined up. And they lined up in order of their speed. And that was a convincing argument. Yes?
It's speculation, but do you think Copernicus could have gone further without the interference of the church?
Do I think Copernicus could have gone further without the interference of the church? No, because he was the church. He was just worried that people outside astronomy would use the Bible to attack him. He certainly was not irreverent. When you read the book, he often steps back and admires the Creator's genius, handiwork. He is a scientist, but he is a believer. And it took him his whole life to finish the book. It wasn't just that he was hesitating out of fear, but he also had difficulty making some of the observations. And Rheticus brought observations when he came, and that helped Copernicus complete the work. So without a telescope, how much farther could he have gone? I mean, the whole problem with his book, the banning of his book, came up because of Galileo, of his discoveries. Yes?
Do you believe the church is labeled as like the antagonist of Copernicus because it was like the curator of academia in that time period?
Do I think the church was labeled as the antagonist because it was the curator of academia? I think it was labeled as the antagonist because his book was placed on the index. I mean, that seemed to set up battle lines. They didn't ban the book. They suspended it until corrected, because they'd already used it to reform the calendar. So they, you know, that was an embarrassing situation. But they had to stop this idea of the heliocentric design. So they suspended it until corrected. 4 years later, they issued the corrections that you were supposed to make in the book if you owned the book. And Galileo's copy of Copernicus survives, and you can see where he dutifully, and one of the things he had to do was to cross out that line. Thus vast is the divine handiwork of the most excellent Almighty. And they objected to that line because it suggested that he knew how the universe was made, which nobody could know. You're standing up. Are we out of time?
We have time for one or two more questions.
Okay. Anybody who has not asked a question yet? Yes, sir.
Did you of writing the play about Copernicus Were you interested in that, for example, Brecht's play about Galileo?
Was I inspired to write my play about Copernicus by Brecht's play about Galileo? Maybe a little bit, because I don't like Brecht's play. I think it really paints Galileo in a bad light. And I've been at conferences, science conferences, where the theater department on campus has wanted to put on a play, and they always put on Brecht's Galileo. And I thought, maybe if I wrote a play about Copernicus, they would put on my play and not constantly make Galileo look bad. No, it was really the idea of these two people, so different, different ages, different religions, all the obstacles against them, that they could come together over this idea and work together, and then their collaboration would result in that book which changed the world. That just appealed to me. Yes?
I read Arthur Kessler's book, The Sleepwalkers, and he mentions in that book that, and it might have something to do with Ptolemy, how Copernicus didn't really center the solar system on the sun, but on a point near the sun, because he couldn't quite figure out how the two systems went together. Is that true?
Yes. The question is, did Copernicus center everything on the sun or a point near the sun? And he never comes down hard on that. He never really says exactly where it is. And that was the problem with his book. But it's because it's impossible to make circular orbits work. So that was his difficulty. Arthur Kessler also said the famous denunciation of Copernicus's book, which is that it was the book that nobody read, because it was so down, so long, so difficult. But Owen Gingerich of Harvard has now given the lie to that condemnation. He has a wonderful book called The Book Nobody Read, which talks about his efforts to find all the 16th century copies of Copernicus's book and see who owned them, who wrote what in the margins. And he has proved conclusively that everybody read that book. And it was powerful, and there were whole schools of marginalia that got copied over in numerous volumes. So, yes?
You said that Rutgers had taken a copy of his book back. Is that still surviving?
The question is, what did Rheticus take? He took a copy, probably a copy he made himself, of Copernicus's manuscript and took it to a printer in Nuremberg. And that copy, the working copy for the printer, that is gone. But Copernicus's own handwritten manuscript is still in existence. Yeah. The gatekeeper? Okay.
I was just going to congratulate you for setting a Guinness Book of Records this morning with the amount of time you got at the Peter Boyle Show for an author. That was.
Oh, really? Okay.
You were on for better part of an hour.
I was on for an hour, yes. Yeah. I didn't realize I was setting a record. Thank you. And did you come here because of Peter Boyle?
No, I came here because of
Pegasus. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.